Welcome to the Animal Fire Podcast, episode 6, titleless.
Whoa.
Today's going to be a really good episode. I have two special guests. That's twice as many special guests as last week.
Hey. Oh,
that's less scary. That's
yes. No. I have Kate Arvin.
Hey.
And M. Jones.
Uh-huh.
They're two, what, actresses?
Women.
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 Oh!
That's what you want on top of your resume?
No,
women?
No, I'm just saying. That's why you brought us here, right?
Yes, that is why. Well,
we know why you brought us here.
There's no other reason.
There might be other reasons. This is not just like the affirmative action podcast.
Actually.
Actually, it really is.
That's what it was yeah. Your last resort.
After 5 episodes, I completely ran out of topics.
Yeah.
So I had to invite
He wanted to talk about the women
here. Here we are.
Yes. Yeah,
they wanted to talk about the thing that they couldn't talk about without us.
The thing that goes unsaid.
That women
exist.
Which
we won't say. So it's going to be a very boring podcast. Anyway, M. Jones and Kate Arvin are both in Hamlet. M. Mm-hmm. plays Ophelia. Kate plays Horatio.
Yo.
Mm-hmm. And they've done tons of other theater stuff, and they do all kinds of different things. They're multi-talented, multifaceted.
Women.
Well, I was going to say thanks for the whole multi-talented thing, but I guess it's nice to notice I'm a woman too. I don't try to hide it or anything, so.
No, although I only cast you in male roles.
That's true.
Which is what we want to talk about today, right? Because Shakespeare gets a little muddy sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you can switch people's genders. It's because it's not copyright, so you can do whatever you want. But that's something that commonly happens. Mm-hmm. Something I do quite often. And it's something you've both played several times, playing male roles written for males in Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And then playing them in different incarnations. And then there's also dealing with, you know, there's a little bit of this play was writ, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And they kind of had different opinions and roles for their characters and kind of going through
what
that.
What is it like coming
arc.
In with a modern perspective on the gender roles that are inherent in each play?
Exactly.
I need some vocabulary words there.
So what is it like? Anything. You're so full like? Of words, you tell
I
me.
I think Em wants to talk about that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you were talking about your modern femininity, right?
yeah. I think that we were talking about how there's room in Shakespeare's plays. The female characters I've played actually allow for my so-called, I guess, modern femininity. Maybe it could be understood as like I have more voice, or I have I feel more free to express emotion or thought than how I perceive women from 400 years ago. And I guess I also think that men played these roles, you know, when the plays were written. And now we're actually, I don't see it as often that nowadays, like, men are playing women's parts, but that might be interesting.
Yeah, well, I think gender roles get switched more often in Shakespeare, not just because it doesn't have a copyright, but because in the acting world, and I'm speaking from a person who worked in a casting department, there are 20 women to every male auditioner. And there are 20 Shakespeare roles to every 4 women roles. So it really, it's hard to cast Shakespeare because you have a smaller pool just if you are constrained by the gender roles that are presented in the script. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think in some ways there's a lot of room to play, especially nowadays there's so much talk about gender expression, gender identity, fluidity.
And
so
your audience is more open to it too.
Yeah, so I think it's invited. It's a chance for, I think people, at least the audience that I know in Olympia, they feel relieved to see that shown on stage where, you know, we're interpreting all kinds of things, taking a play that was written 400 years ago. We're interpreting the language, making it modern. We're, you know, reworking.
We're translating it.
We're translating it, having different costume, you know, different relationships that would make sense to us now that wouldn't, because we can't relate to, you know, the royalty, you know, the way things are set up.
Well, and if you're going to change anything, you might as well use all of the tools at your disposal. And, you know, there's a set of tools that comes with being a woman that can work with some characters, some roles, some situations that, you know, would be otherwise closed to you if you were casting it traditionally or, you know, writing it traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do when you get cast in one of those roles that was written as a male character? Although it's interesting because, like you said, all of the characters were going to be played by males in Shakespeare's
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
So really, they're all written to be portrayed by male actors.
Right. You really don't see, you might see a female Hamlet someday, but you're not going to see mm-hmm. a male Ophelia.
That might be interesting. I mean, sure it's been done.
You might.
There's been those.
Yeah. Really? Oh, I haven't seen any.
Yeah.
I would like to, though. Well, you know, we've seen some interesting stuff done in this town last couple of years. Mm-hmm. We saw Romeo and Juliet that was played with two men. And
two women.
Well, yeah, there's two. There was the Dow production did two men, and then the one you were in did two women.
Yeah. That one I played Fire Lawrence as a female mm-hmm. also. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was another gender switch.
And there's sometimes, I think some of those productions are more successful than others, and it has to do with, does it add to the story or does it take something away from the story,
or is
it neutral? If it's neutral, fine.
Yeah.
But as long as you're still telling the story, still communicating the emotions and the truth that you're trying to highlight, then great, mm-hmm. awesome, go for it. But if it's something like if it's just one of those things where, now I'm going to get all inarticulate. Here's another thing. Okay, you can talk about gender and you can talk about aesthetic. I once saw a production of Macbeth done in the steampunk version. Mm-hmm. I'm putting air quotes around that for those of you who can't tell. And it was terrible because they kept talking about being in Scotland and they made no reference in the text to why the hell did they have goggles and, you know, all these weird, you know, pipes and gears all over them the whole time. And that
so it was
didn't
inconsistent and
yeah.
distracting.
Was
it
the Scotland part that bothered you or was it just, it didn't make sense at all?
Well, you know, they didn't reinvent Scotland for me. They didn't make Scotland this other fictional place.
A steampunk world.
Right. If they had been able to do that, then it would have been like, oh, cool, there's this fictional place called Scotland. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
But no, they kept talking about it as this, like, the Scotland that is still in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That you can still see.
I think that makes sense. I mean, making what people look for I assume what I look for in watching a show has to do with some, if I can relate to it, if I can mm-hmm. understand the relationships.
Right.
And, I think, of course, that being, you know, being female and playing a variety of roles, whether it's like playing an old man character or a young woman, and I think we get to relate to, we get more room there. The more diverse the people who are playing the mm-hmm. the parts are, the more room there is to interpret, identify with the characters. So mm-hmm. I think it's awesome when people are from diverse backgrounds, diverse in age, gender expression,
race. Yeah, it widens your scope of understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me because sometimes when you're acting in a play like Angels in America comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
where this very old male rabbi is typically played by a woman made up and with a big beard and a lot of like prosthetics and, mm-hmm. and kind of mm-hmm. designed to make you think it's an old man. That this young woman is playing. Whereas in Shakespeare, sometimes you get to take this character that is written as a man, but then change it. You don't, you know, if you're playing Horatio mm-hmm. like you are, Kate, we're not making you up as a man.
No,
we're not, you know, Horatio is just a woman in this production.
Right. And Midsummer, Peter Quince wore a skirt.
Yes, exactly.
Mm. I was Peter Quince. Mm-hmm.
So you've done this twice now.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like you can bring your own perspective to a character and the story just gets told slightly differently.
Mm-hmm,
and you
sure.
get to have
well,
this
yeah,
interesting
it definitely
thing.
Changes the story. Like when you told me I was cast as Horatio, I was like, how the hell did he think of that?
Mm.
Like I couldn't imagine like what made Austin look at me and say, Horatio.
Mm.
But, you know, I sat down with the character and I sat down with the script. And what I thought about was like, well, how is it, you know, I guess any actor thinks about this. What is my relationship to this character,
right.
this character? So I thought about my relationship with Hamlet. What is it and how does it change with Horatio being female. Does it change that they're friends? No, not really. It actually, I kind of liked it because in our version, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are still male, but Hamlet has a very different relationship with them than he does Horatio. And that's in the script. And so it makes sense for Horatio to be different than them both. I guess he's from a different part of the country as well, but also.
I just thought of this, and it's kind of interesting how now Hamlet's really the three people he's closest to in the show are Horatio, who's a woman, Ophelia, who's a woman, and then his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so you suddenly have this character surrounded by these three women he has these different relationships with.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't it also give us a chance to see different relationships between, you know, male-female relationships? I mean, if you're playing Horatio as a female, then we get to see not just the romance or the mother-son relationship.
Yeah,
but I like that aspect of it.
Yeah,
and
it brings out three different aspects of friendship. Relationships, I guess.
I played Oberon last summer, and that was also like a chance to, you know, that was a little different because Oberon's magical. And so there's a little bit more room to just, I guess, androgyny kind of came up in thinking about that character, and that as a fairy being, like, we kind of relax more around gender lines.
Right.
Like, anyone gets to be the fairy king, and you get to express all kinds of energy and have all kinds of loves, and you get to be, you know, maybe like sexual with everything, or have magical fairy juice, and you know, like
right, non-gendered fairy juice.
Well, they reproduce by budding. Like a little fairy just kind of grows in your arm and then falls off.
That's
so gross.
Nice. I guess I almost thought of Oberon as almost like a close to a hermaphrodite being.
Yeah. Well, you know, so it was interesting. I ran into a friend of mine the other day, and they were asking me about who's in the show, who's playing this, who's playing that. I was like, oh, who's playing your Ophelia? I was like, oh, the person who played our Oberon.
Mm.
And they're like, what? Wait, I mean, I saw that show. I don't remember that person being female. It's like, she was. Yeah, and it was cool. I think that was what I really enjoyed about your performance last year was that, you know, the important things about Oberon is his power.
Yeah.
And that wasn't necessarily connected to whatever kind of genitals he had.
And jealousy. You know?
Those are emotions that you have no problem expressing and, you know, acting. So it really, really worked.
That's nice to hear because, of course, as I identify as female out in the world. Mm-hmm. And so to take that on.
I would describe you as a feminine person.
And have people in the audience not see that. That's good to hear. Because, I mean, a lot of people I know saw me and people project gender on, you know, onto everything. I mean, that's where we come from.
Yeah. Well, we weren't trying to completely mask you either.
Right. We thought about that kind of like disguising, going way more masculine. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it felt like just the character wanted to be a lot more fluid. Mm-hmm. And
well, and that freedom, I think, gave you a lot more to play with as an actor.
Definitely.
Too.
Yeah, I just didn't seem to need it because you in your normal clothes as everyday M was still interesting to watch have those interactions. So it's like, well, why do we don't need to change that. We don't need to put a beard on the rabbi.
Doesn't necessarily add anything to...
What was an interesting thing, and I think you were kind of punking me on this, and it was a joke you and the actress playing Titania did, is one of the last nights for that the final moment in Midsummer, they just basically come out and wave to the audience more or less. There's some like poetry, but it's just kind of like a cameo, like, yeah, the play's over, here's everybody. And you
we never talked about this.
No, you two switched costumes.
Yeah, we did. Do you remember that?
No,
I'm facing the other way
on stage at that point.
And it worked. It was a weird kind of moment. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of dug it.
We ran into the woods, which is our backstage, and we quickly switched costumes. It is one of my favorite things to play a prank, and we did this. I did one in Bald Soprano also, which is pretty good. But that was fabulous, actually.
Yeah.
And it was fun to just embody Titania for a moment and get to be Fairy Queen.
Yeah, I don't know. It was cool. It kind of worked. It's the kind of thing that maybe we could have played more of, or if we'd thought to do that earlier on, it could have maybe borne some fruit or something.
That would be interesting if halfway through the show, switching... all of a sudden, Titania became Oberon, and Oberon became Titania. You can really play with the binaries in a person, like the two sides of a person, by having two different bodies filling the same character.
But going back to what you said earlier, though, I mean, it does make it easier in that play because they're magical characters.
Right.
And I think when you do that in a straight play or I'll say drama, I guess it could be comedy too, but less so in the comedies, though, because if you think about the characters that cross-dress in Shakespeare, like Viola and Twelfth Night and Rosalind and As You Like It, it's always like it's usually the women dressing up as men, and they generally pass to the other characters. But you rarely see the men dress up as the women and it be as successful. But it is. I think when you're doing that in a straight play, whether it's in the script or not, you have to put a wider set of definitions down. Like you have to define the gender binaries or the gender perceptions or rules within the world of the play, and you have to be able to communicate that to your audience and set that as the groundwork, because otherwise it's confusing, and that's when it becomes distracting.
Sure.
That's one of my favorite things to do in Shakespeare that I think not people don't do enough or deeply is world creation.
Absolutely.
Like the steampunk Macbeth you talked about, like you get to make your entire world. In my mind, in my weird, crazy mind, most Shakespeare's are fantasies. Like there's always some, even in Hamlet, which is considered, you know, the most cerebral Western drama, it has a ghost.
Right. It has a ghost, and this guy talks to himself a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, he does. Yeah,
magic.
You know?
And it's an ambiguous Denmark. Shakespeare had no idea what Denmark was like. You know,
Midsummer, there's that line, "Now I am invisible."
Yeah. Yes.
We just accept that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, so you gotta lay down what's going to be okay and what's not. Mm-hmm. And you have to give those parameters. Otherwise, it's this loosey-goosey thing that you can't really perceive or can't really, you know, conceptualize and get with as an audience member.
I think, too, if you don't set those rules up, then your actors don't know the boundaries to the game. Like, if acting is just a game you play, then you've got to know which game you're playing and how the rules are, because then you have freedom within restrictions. Otherwise, anything goes, and you get a real uneven experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, sometimes I can't define those rules. Like you said earlier, you know, why you as Horatio? It's a weird thing because I do often, like, you know, some... Like, for the practical reason, like you said, there are, like, you know, a lot more female actors. But also some characters in my mind just to go, oh, that a woman could play that character. That character could be a woman. But I don't have a real – I couldn't write down, like, a flow chart saying character X, does it do this or this? Then, yes, it can be a female, or no, it has to be a male. It's just – I don't know. It's a weird system. Plus, you know people well, so you kind of, like – You read the character
that
and
person fits
personalities kind of mesh together. It's an odd thing.
Well, I want to say one more thing about playing Ophelia as a person of this day, because there are, like, for a long time, this character has been, she's a young woman and she has a lot of direction and constraints put upon her. And
she's pushed around a lot.
Exactly.
She's always being told
she's
what
to pawn. You know, that's a way of interpreting it. And what there's an opportunity here in my mind not to just recreate the history of sexism and how it's affected. You know,
because
I mean, not just portray that as like, yes, I'm a subservient young woman and my life is ruined because of this and this. But and I lose my mind. But I'm actually thinking of her as being a truth teller of sorts and actually seeing what's going on in a way that no one else is willing to say. I mean, she's vocal and in front of people in a way that, you know, I mean, maybe no other character is in.
Yeah, actually, I like that. That actually fits with how I view Horatio, too, because Horatio is definitely a truth teller and definitely a witness. Like, Horatio doesn't actually do anything in this play. Horatio just follows people around and is told to go places and then told, you know, even at the end, it's like, no, don't do that. You stay so you can tell the story later. Like, that's Horatio is like the audience advocate. He's there so that something can be explained to the audience.
Horatio makes one active choice in the play and is instantly stopped.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, like you said, truth teller, it's a perspective, and it's, you know, basically this play is being seen through characters like yours and mine. Mm-hmm. We are interpreting the story. We're watching what's happening, and we're the advocate we're the storyteller later.
I like that. Advocating for your characters.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing. I think mm-hmm. I feel more comfortable with Ophelia, not as... I know there's the famous book Reviving Ophelia, which mm-hmm. is like an adolescent girl, depressed,
There's a stage adaptation to that, by
the
way. Oh,
really? So, how to revive our adolescent girls of today. And mm-hmm. I just think that there's more to her. I think that she might... take into her own hands her life, which is actually a really powerful action at mm-hmm. the end. And there's Gertrude's interpretation of what happened, but maybe, I don't know the whole story.
Well, I think Gertrude takes a pretty active role in interpreting that too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, there's a lot of woman power in this show.
Yeah.
She also seems to be able to suddenly say whatever she wants in the scene where she goes mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She all of a sudden, it's like all these thoughts that were bubbling underneath the surface just come out, and she's like, "I'm crazy now, but I don't care. I mean, my dad's dead."
Well, it's interpreted as crazy,
yes.
Which right. and a lot of women throughout history who've been quote unquote crazy mm-hmm. are people who are saying this is the truth for me, and mm-hmm. Maybe it's not.
Are being burned as witches?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it reminds me of that, and in that way, I'm really proud to be part of this lineage of people who are. Speaking this voice, speaking of this experience of being treated as though they're mad and really mm-hmm. maybe saying something really real and important.
She's really driven to a lot,
Wow, that was a really good ending sentence.
Oh, thank God.
So let's take it and roll with it.
Okay.
Thank you both for coming. This has been a lot of fun.
And thank you.
Hamlet
it's
opens
been a blast.
In... Gosh, less than 3 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
July 19th.
We should probably learn our lines now. Huh?
You should. And I should probably start showing up. So,
that'd be nice.
AnimalFireTheater.com, Facebook.com/AnimalFireTheater, Podomatic.com, Animal Fire Theater Podcast. And that's it. That's episode 6.
Whoa.
Yeah. Thank
hurrah.
You.
Take us out, Brian. Groovy.